Well, they can't taste or do what he says anything.
Yeah. Okay. And the second guy we hadn't met, but he'd been in before. So we were batched up and processed through that day, and we ended up getting a house together, this friend of mine and I, and the other guy stayed with us for a while. But as we began to get into the training program, we were matched up with a larger group of people who may have come in on a different day,
yeah,
or may have been a little bit out of cycle. But we all were sort of in the same kind of training. And there were periods...
And so pretty much that class of 30 progressed through us, and then you all got shipped over together.
And we all got shipped over to Laos and Vietnam. And
when did your training... When was that completed?
It was pretty much completed within a year. It was about a year cycle. So I went to Vietnam in November of 1970.
Okay.
I joined in November of 69 and went over in November of 70. It was something like that. I had a little extra time. I had 6 weeks of Vietnamese. So most of the other guys went overseas before I did, but not by much.
What kind of... I've heard about some of the trainers in this program, guys like Rip Robertson, some of the legendary people in the in the program who had done lots of time in Vietnam.
Yeah.
Some of them have been, actually helped create the Pru. Mm-hmm. I've been there when they were called CTs, counter-terrorists.
Mm-hmm.
Were those the people who were giving you instruction?
Most of the instructors we had were permanent staff who were skilled in the various... paramilitary sorts of training.
Experts in demolition and experts in small arms.
Yeah.
That kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Okay.
I don't recall from that year of training, I don't recall getting any specific training for the Phoenix program.
Yeah. Nobody said you're going over there to participate in Phoenix or Pru or anything like that.
Nobody came in to say, oh, here's so and so who's been spent 2 years with Phoenix in Vietnam, and he's going to brief you on Phoenix because you're. I don't recall anything like that.
Okay, well, that was the what I was wondering is if it was if you were being trained specifically for that, or if you could have been put anywhere in the world.
In the world,
if you could have gone to Angola.
That was my impression was that part of our training was to learn how to survive in snow in the mountains.
Okay.
Not much application for that in Vietnam. You got a little snow and a lot in the, for a few days of the year, and that was it.
Okay.
It was a general program, the same for everybody. And as I recall, maybe one or two of our people didn't even go to the Far East.
Okay, so when you got to Vietnam, did you go to Vong Tau and then get Pru training there?
I did not, and I'll tell you, I don't know of anybody that did. What generally happened in Vietnam was you arrived, you processed, you got your province or your region or whatever. You went up there and you got, a couple of days, a week sort of OJT, you get your feet on the ground. We were trained to drop in any place and do the job.
Okay.
In my case, it was a little unusual because I was supposed to go to the Delta.
Okay.
And I talked to my Koik ahead of time. He was back in Washington on consultations, and I was slotted for the Delta. And I talked to him, and he was a great guy, and we were going
to
have a good time.
What province
and everything was
going to
be great.
Go to?
It was some Delta province, and it's all vague to me now. I arrived in Saigon, and they said, there's been a change. Okay? In Fuyen, the guy that had my job in Fuyen had basically gone a little crazy.
Okay.
He locked himself in his room with a gun. He threatened to kill people. He was flipped out.
Yeah, I've heard that more than once.
Yeah, and they had
That's
to come up.
The most
he was
part.
Not. He never went through our training.
Okay.
He shouldn't have been there. But it was one of these. It's a long story.
Was he an in-country hire?
He was a guy that had worked as a filing clerk for 7 or 8 years with the agency.
Okay.
Wanted to go to Vietnam because, gee, that's so exciting. And he'd gotten a job in the region, in MR2, pushing papers.
Yeah.
His predecessor, up where I was, had gotten booted out for hitting a priest.
Let me interrupt you for a minute, okay?
Yeah, good. The guy wasn't Ted Sloan, was it?
No.
Oh, okay.
No.
I had done an interview with the province senior advisor, no. Fu Yen, from 66 to 69.
Yeah, see, Gary Chow,
okay,
was the first special police advisor there, Gary Chow. And he was a Chinese-American. And he was there for 2 years. He was very popular. He was very successful. He was fair. He was tough. He was all of the things you want. My recollection was that he was replaced by a guy who had been doing the work up in Bin Din in Quinyon.
Okay.
And I think there were two or three of them up in Bin Din because the province was so big.
Yes.
And one was sort of in a junior position, and when Gary left, this guy came down. And he was getting well established, and, you know, things seemed to be going pretty well. But when this incident happened, apparently it had some dispute with this priest on something anyway. And, you know, there's a certain number of sort of peaceniks and Bible translators and people like that in country, and they didn't like certain types of civilians.
Yeah.
They made it pretty clear, and
it was an American priest.
I think it was an American. He was a Catholic, and he was over there for some, Bible translator or whatever. In any event, he was wearing his cassock when he was driving the Jeep, and he drove over the guy's towel on his radio, and the guy just flipped out, and it was. You know, it's a big beach.
Yeah.
The towel, the radio. I mean, it was pretty obvious. I may put my machine on.
Okay. Things a bit now.
Can't be too summary.
Yeah. No. Yeah.
Okay. So, all right, what we're talking about is the Prue advisor.
He was the special police advisor.
Okay. And this is not Gary Chow.
No.
This is the guy before Gary Chow.
This is the guy after Gary.
Okay.
The guy after Gary came in, he got in this tiff with a priest, hit him, bloodied his nose. The priest went up the province senior advisor's house, and the province chief's house were located on a compound within a few hundred yards of our compound on the beach.
So you weren't co-located with the province chief?
No. Here's Tuiwa. Our house, the compound, the senior advisor's compound was right about there.
Okay.
And our house was down about here.
Okay. Now, is it Jim Engel?
No. I really won't remember his name because I never met the guy.
Okay.
I don't, there's no way that I can really recall his name.
Well, that's interesting. So you didn't really have relations with the province senior advisor? You just...
The province senior advisor at the time I arrived was Russell Meredink.
Meredink.
He was replaced by Mr. Floyd.
Okay.
And Russell Meredink, well, with a name like Meredink, he had a lot of nicknames.
He was in a lot of provinces over the years. He wasn't just in...
I couldn't figure him out. He was too young. He was a jerk. Don't quote me on that.
Okay, so the guy who was after Chow, he hit the priest, and then the guy after him was the one who ended up in the room with the gun.
So what happened was,
when
the guy who hit the priest went up and complained.
Okay.
It became a bit of an incident, so they took the guy out of province and shipped him off to another province.
Okay.
And then, they said, Jesus, we've got to get somebody up here. Well, this guy, John somebody or other, from Nha Trang, who had been pushing papers, oh man, he really liked these guys that were, the bangers and the boomers, that's what they call them, and knuckle draggers, and boy, he would love to get out in the field, and he was, geez, I've been here for a year, and I've done my job, and boy, could I go up to Fu Yen, and they sent him up there, and that was a big mistake. Morales was the Roik at the time.
Yeah, so Jerry Morales.
Not Jerry, it was Dave Morales.
Okay.
And he'd been involved in Guatemala, he was an old hand, and he was a friend of Ted Shackley's.
Yeah.
And Morales let this guy go up there, probably because he didn't like him. And the guy went up there, and the first night he was there, there was a mortar attack. And I think a few rounds fell in the compound. It happened on a regular basis. But that really freaked him out. And then there was an ambush or something. Somebody was going to the air base.
Directed against him personally.
Well, that's what it, yeah, that's what it got to. But you see, down here was the Tui, this area was the Tui Wai air base, and that's where the PX was.
Okay.
And so we had to come down and across the bridge to get to the thing. And some soldiers, some GIs or somebody was were going in that night to get laid, and they got ambushed, and a couple were killed. So he began to suddenly say,
What have I gotten into?
And
there's a risk involved with
and
this stuff.
He began to walk around with flak jackets all the time, and he really got into weapons, and he wouldn't go anywhere without weapons.
Yeah.
He began to drink a lot, and he apparently got drunk one day and peed. It was Thanksgiving Day. See, it was November. We're in the November time frame. They're having some party over at the U.S. military area. He got drunk and he peed on the steps of the dining hall.
Yeah, he's trying to get himself sectioned 8 out.
He was really making a fool of himself.
Yeah.
And then he got on the radio and radioed down in a Trang to the people he knew down there and said, these people up here are crazy, they're trying to kill me.
Yeah.
He locked himself in his room and posted one of the guards outside his door and told the guard that if anyone came near to shoot.
Yeah.
And the guards were all going, yeah, like this.
Yeah.
The Nungs, we have Nung guards. So, I mean, the guy was just flipping out. They finally sent an airplane up to get him. And he refused to leave his room until the guy he knew on the airplane came in to get him to make sure he was safe.
Yeah.
And then he wouldn't let them touch any of his weapons, and he kept his pistol loaded. And they told him that he couldn't fly on the airplane with a Car 15 loaded.
Yeah.
So he eventually unloaded that and held it on his lap. But he kept his 9mm loaded.
Yeah.
And they flew him back down, and they just got it.
Well, what kind of impact did that have on you?
Hey,
that's the question.
Well,
you know,
this is it. So
you're
saying
to myself, "I got to replace this guy. What's it going to do to me?"
I fly into the country with this nice job that I'm going to take in the Delta, where I've met the boss and everything else.
And you're
going
to be a police advisor.
Advisor, and
okay.
I'm told there's been a little problem. You're going to Phu Yen, and you're going up there right now. So you know, I guess. To get back to your original thing, did I get any training? No, I was processed through a day or so in Saigon, and then I went up to Da Nang, and I spent about a day there, and they kind of looked at me and sort of, you know, poked me and touched me and said, do you hit priests? Are you crazy? You know, are you gun shy? What kind of, you know? And they all said, well, he looks pretty good. He's been in Vietnam before. He was here for a year and a half in the military.
Yeah.
Senate Phu Yen has earned, you know, Phu Yen needs somebody good.
Yeah.
They've had somebody really good, and then they've had two problems. And I arrive, and my counterpart looks at me, and he says, hey. I said, I want to work together with you, but he says, hey. He says, Mr. Chow, he was great. Then we had the other guy, he's gone. Then we had this other guy, he's gone. He said, how long do you plan to be here?
Yeah, yeah.
How many weeks?
Yeah, okay.
So, I mean, it was a tough...
All right, now, is your counterpart the province PRU commander?
My counterpart is the special police chief.
Okay. Okay.
Now, in MR2, the PRU had a regional PRU advisor, whatever you want to call it. And he would, it was a big region, and he would fly around.
But not people in each province?
Not people in each province.
Okay.
Now, that's a difference.
Yeah, that's amazing. That's a big difference. This is the first region that's been the situation.
Yeah.
Let me back up. That I met a guy, and his name is John Wilbur, and he's a Yale graduate. He's now a lawyer in Palm Beach. I went down there and interviewed him. He ran the PRU when they started assigning region directors who reported to Bill Riddell.
Mm-hmm.
He ran the Delta PRU
from
67 into 68, and he was replaced by a Navy guy named Chuck Lemoyne.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and he would go around, and he would make sure all the PRU guys were, which were mostly enlisted men who had, you know, gone over to the agency, were running the proof teams, you know, they wrote the reports properly, and they were getting out and doing an operation or two a week. But he told me that they had that structure in every region.
Yeah.
Where they had a region Prue advisor who then oversaw guys in each province who were running a province team.
Look at look at the map. Look at MR2.
Very big, yes.
It's huge. What's the population of MR2?
Less than any other.
Very small.
Yeah.
It just didn't make sense to have the same sort of Prue structure there. And what you had was my buddy, and I saw him actually a couple of months ago. He came up to visit. Jack Harrell, H-A-R-R-E-L-L, was the MR2 Prue advisor. I believe he worked alone. He may have worked with one other person, but he flew all over. He would visit each of the provinces. He would come in, he would stay with us for the night, he would meet his people, he would pay his people, he would take care of them. What do you need? How many are on the rolls? What kind of ops do you have? He was 6'4", 230 pounds, all muscle, Navy career. He was the Navy guy.
So he was in your class?
Yeah.
And he went over with you?
He went over.
And he got the job as...
As it turned out, when I arrived, he was not the Prue guy. He'd been down at MR3, but then they moved him up to MR2 for this job.
Okay.
And he was, I believe... His title was, you know, MR2 Prue Advisor. And so occasionally something would come up with the Prue Chief or with the Prue, and we would get involved, but not often.
Okay.
That wasn't the way it was supposed to work.
So what is the relationship in Fujian between the special police and the Prue? I mean, now in most provinces, they're two completely separate things, with the Prue running unilateral operations for the Poik and having and actually in many cases working against the special police and checking along.
In Fujian, it was similar to that.
Okay.
But because, you know, every organization looks for a godfather, you know, a parent. Because the Prue in our area was not, you know, fully and completely taken care of by a resident American.
Okay.
There was a tendency for the Prue chief to get along better.
Okay.
With the police forces.
I got you.
And they did. I don't know about the other provinces, but our Prue chief and the special police chief and the police chief themselves, they knew each other.
Mm-hmm.
They were cordial. They got along reasonably well. Now, everybody in a...
Mm-hmm.
My counterpart, special police chief, was a former foreign legionnaire. And, you know, everybody wants to control all the action. I mean, if he, in a perfect world, he would have wanted to control the Prue, but he couldn't, and he knew that, and he accepted that, and they didn't really try.
Okay. Did he make it to America? Or did he commit suicide?
No, they shot him. That's my understanding. I never knew what really happened to him.
What was his name?
Nguyen Thanh. I was told, T-A-M, I was told he was shot. A number of others were captured and were killed. The district chief in Houston, they made a big deal about killing him.
Where was your pick? Can you show me on your map?
Yeah, I think so. I have photos. The pick was...
you wouldn't happen to have a photo of the pick, would you?
Yeah, I do.
That'd be great.
Let me see... I don't have a good aerial of the city, but we're out here on the beach, and that was, you know, as you can see, there's a river that runs through.
I see.
And at night, they would close each of these roads and put a checkpoint out, and the VC would still come into this area and
mop around. Is that a police or military checkpoint?
Would be military, because the province chiefs, house and offices were about here.
Mm-hmm.
We were here. The military advisors compound was down here. Most of your Americans were out here with the with most of the high-ranking Vietnamese.
That's your MACV advisory team.
Yeah, the MACV advisory team. Meridink's house and quarters were out here.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the police station, as I recall, geez, it's been a while.
Downtown,
it's probably. Downtown, somewhere in this area down in here. I see this big patch of green, and I have the feeling that it was, you know, it was somewhere, where's the square? Here's the square over here. Maybe it was over in here. It was mm-hmm. somewhere downtown. The PIC was co-located with the police station. It was in the grounds of the police station.
So it wasn't on the outskirts of town. Most no. PICs usually are on the outskirts of
no.
town.
This was
more downtown.
Yeah, it was more downtown. I can't see it from that photo. There may be some other photo that's better for purposes of identifying exactly.
Well, what percentage of your time did you spend at the PIC? Could you say 15, 20%? You know,
yeah.
An average.
Here's my office here, which was a Quonset hut. This is on the police, the grounds of the police station. It's within the police compound. Now, Gary Chow, this office housed Vietnamese translators.
Okay.
Who would receive the reports from the PIC in Vietnamese,
okay,
and scan them and translate the good ones into English.
Yeah,
and then we would disseminate those in reports.
Okay,
and it was sort of I found that I had it.
Were there any Phoenix people there?
Not really. I mean,
okay.
The work they did, we might might be disseminated to the Americans doing Phoenix work, but
okay.
But there weren't nobody in here was being paid by the Phoenix program per se.
Okay.
Now the PIC was located around the corner from here, again on the police grounds.
Okay.
So I would just walk out and around, and there it was.
Okay.
You would be great if you had a shot.
Yeah, see, you walk out the door, you go under the trees and around past here, and the PIC's on the back. And these are the photos I have of the PIC, which aren't really... It's hard to take a photo of a building like this.
No, I understand, because, it's exactly as
the
guy described to me, the water tower with
tower.
The generator underneath.
Yeah, there's a generator. You've got the various little, cubicles.
Mm-hmm.
You've got the areas where they stay in the interrogation rooms. I think you got storage. They all followed a similar design.
Yeah, you walk in through the green gate.
Yeah.
And
green gate.
On the left side is your reception room where a person's processed in.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hello.
Okay.
Yes. Hi, Farrell. How are you?
I actually had that job first, and it was Googleman who went around and actually set up and built all those things originally.
See, now that guy there worked in my office, and I don't remember his name. He was a very nice guy. And to give you a feel for how we would do things, like I said, Gary Chow would work in the compound in the Quonset hut. That was his office.
Okay.
My two other predecessors did not. They would sit out at the residential compound.
Where they lived. And then they would go next door to
and
where the province officer was and just be very safe and secure
and
no hands on.
And occasionally they'd drive down and to talk to the police chief. And that was bullshit.
That's more dangerous, too, because you're a stranger to everything that's happened. You're not aware yet. It's like if you go out into the woods, you can learn what's going on. You can feel at home.
Yeah. Well, I went down there and said, I'm gonna work out of the Quonset hut, but because I spoke some Vietnamese, that was good for me and good for them.
Okay.
And in fact, I moved my desk out of the back and put it right up front, right near the front door, so that nobody could go in or out without me seeing and sort of keeping track of what was going on. But it also allowed me to wander around the police station, to go to the PIC unannounced at any point in time.
Mm-hmm.
That guy there that's running in front of the camera as I'm taking a picture of the Lambros worked in my office as a translator. And the translators, I got them to sort of, you know, keep good relations with the PIC people. And, oh, you know, we give them a few groceries, or we get this, or we get cigarettes, or a little booze. And so my translators were in and out of the PIC a lot. They would get, sometimes we would ask for them to work with a special prisoner for particular types of information. And occasionally I would do the interrogation myself for somebody that seemed to be reluctant to work with the South Vietnamese or with any Vietnamese, but you know, if an American comes in and he's alone and he speaks a little bit of the language, maybe they'll warm up to him. So I did some of it myself. The whole focus was to try to have good relations with the police, was to ensure that prisoners were being properly treated, because as far as I was concerned, the PIC program was an American program, and if it didn't run right, it was going to make us look bad.
Well, how many, did you have a special police officer who was your PIC chief?
Yes, but the PIC chief worked for the, you know, he was a policeman.
A special branch police.
Okay. That's correct.
But so he reports to the national police chief.
That's right. He reports up through the police structure, but he also knows that the building was built. See, they were built and then turned over.
Yes, I understand.
Okay.
Yeah.
But he also knows that, hey, you know, this building came from the guy in the Quonset hut.
Also, special branch salaries are paid
special
by the
branch.
Americans, not
yeah.
by
That's
the Vietnamese.
Right. And okay. also the agents.
Yeah.
If you got a hot agent that you want to recruit, the money comes.
Yeah.
So
the informant networks.
The informant networks.
Yeah.
And so you know, I was very interested in the informant network. I was very interested in some of the quality interrogation that was going on.
Mm-hmm.
And I had access to resources so that I could manage these things, so I could get what I wanted.
You have a busy.
I apologize for this.
Van Hai, you're a national police chief?
No, and I've got the name of the guy in.
Okay. Not Tran Van Ba.
That's a little closer.
Okay. Anyway, who's your boss?
I can't tell you my boss's name. My boss is an American. He's the Poik.
Okay.
But I can't tell you, he's no longer with the agency, but he was there in funny name, and so I don't know his real name.
Okay. Was he an old-time guy?
Yeah.
You know, because, you know, they were having problems with the...
Tran Quang Nam.
Tran Quang Nam.
Yeah, and I believe he was from Saigon. Let's see if I can find another reference here.
Now, is the PIC chief the ranking special branch officer in the province?
No.
Okay.
No. Yeah, Tran Quang Nam again, and then... and where's Nguyen Tom? I saw his name here somewhere. But Nam was... Chief Nam was a very smart, very well-educated guy from Saigon, and he was considered one of the so-called progressives in the police structure. I'm not sure exactly why he was in Saigon. There was some Phu Yen. There was some thought that, you know, a relative had pissed off somebody, and so he got sent up there to do his penance, if you will, and that, you know, he was hoping to go back. But he was a very good fellow, a very good man.
How big a staff did the Poik have?
The Poik had 3 or 4 Americans, depending on the period of time. Generally, it was 3 Americans working with him.
And is one his special branch liaison?
Yeah,
that's you.
That's the special police. That's me, the paramilitary guy. He had 2 people. When I was there, he had, there was himself.
Mm-hmm.
There was one guy working closely with the Koreans.
The Blue Dragon?
I forget, there were 2 Korean regiments in our province, one south, one north.
Okay.
And one would do liaison with the Koreans, and then you had the special police advisor who did everything except the pick, and then you had a guy doing the pick. So you had two contractors and two staffers.
So are you the special police advisor at the pick as opposed to the special police advisor?
No, I was the special police advisor overall.
Okay.
In a way, I outranked the guy at the pick. And when the guy at the pick left, okay, he wasn't replaced, and I assumed responsibility for that. As you know, towards 1972, they were phasing things out.
And a lot of the Phoenix people in other provinces start getting some of these jobs, like the job that you took.
Yeah.
A lot of the Phoenix people in some, you know, every province was different, and it was all hit and miss lots of times. Yeah. But
so what you're talking about is a poik who's responsible for the country team, if you will, for the intel team. Okay. Then he's got a UO officer, which is what the other staffer did, unilateral operations.
Okay.
That guy would work independently to develop sources of intelligence in the province.
And he would do that through a counterpart Vietnamese?
He would usually do it through a principal agent, a PA. And that principal agent or the subsidiary agents were usually totally unaffiliated with the police or with the military. They were usually civilians.
Yeah.
But I can assure you that over the years,